Okay, so let's just unpack all of this. It is March 2nd, 2026, and if you've been anywhere near a news feed in the last 24 hours, your head is probably just spinning.
Oh, absolutely. It's been wild.
Right. I mean, we are talking about over 120 new products unveiled across three major global events,
Yeah.
all in a single day. It's an absolute avalanche of information.
It really is. It's one of those days where the signal to noise ratio gets completely out of whack.
Yeah.
Because for the average person, it just looks like this blur of shiny new gadgets and endless press releases.
Yeah,
But,
exactly.
you know, if you stop and actually look at the technical documentation, the strategic announcements that dropped today, there is a very, very specific pattern emerging here.
Right, and that is exactly why we're doing this deep dive today. We aren't just going to sit here and read off spec sheets or recite press releases to you. When you look at the big picture from Blizzard to Nvidia to the hardware giants over in Shenzhen, it really feels like we are seeing a theme of, well, reconstruction.
Exactly. I'd actually call it infrastructure rebuilding.
Infrastructure rebuilding.
Yeah.
Yep.
We're seeing these major players essentially ripping up the floorboards. They aren't just slapping a fresh coat of paint on last year's tech. They are fundamentally rebuilding the underlying structures of their technology, their business models, and even entire gaming genres.
So to help you make sense of all this chaos, we've put together a bit of a roadmap for today's deep dive. We are looking at six tectonic earthquakes, as one of our source reports called them.
I like that phrasing.
Right. So we've got the resurrection of a 22-year-old gaming empire, a foldable phone that honestly seems to defy physics, AI literally taking over cell towers, a massive assault on the premium smartphone market, the rebirth of a legendary industry conference, and the return of the absolute scariest game I have ever played.
It's a packed slate today, and every single one of those points right back to that core theme of infrastructure.
So let's just dive right into the deep end, the digital foundation. We have to talk about World of Warcraft. Today, the Midnight expansion went live.
Big day for MMO fans.
Huge. It's the 11th expansion. They're going back to Quel'Thalas, fighting the Void, classic high fantasy stakes. But if you actually read the patch notes, the real headline isn't the war against the Void. It's something players have been begging for since, gosh, since vanilla WoW W.
Layer housing, they finally did it.
Player housing, but this isn't just, The Sims Azeroth edition. I was reading the technical breakdown on how they actually implemented this, and it is kind of terrifying from a server architecture perspective.
Oh, it's a nightmare. One analyst actually called it an architectural confession.
An architectural confession. What does that mean exactly?
Well, think about it. Blizzard didn't avoid adding player housing for 22 years just because they were being stubborn.
Right.
They didn't do it because their old infrastructure literally couldn't handle the load.
Because of the instance load, right,
That
since every house is separate.
precisely. Every single player house requires a totally separate server instance. So imagine millions of players logging in today for the launch. If even half of them decide to enter their private house at the exact same time, you are suddenly spinning up millions of separate server instances simultaneously.
Wow.
That is a massive computational load that the old legacy Blizzard servers just would have choked on completely.
So the fact that they are launching this feature now on launch day of all days with the highest traffic, that signals something massive about their backend.
It signals that they are now fully leaning on Microsoft's cloud infrastructure. Remember, under the Microsoft umbrella, Blizzard now has access to Azure's massive scaling capabilities.
Yeah, of course.
So this is effectively the greatest stress test in cloud gaming history. If the servers hold up today, it proves that the MMO service model has been completely rebuilt from the ground up.
It's wild to think about. Like you, the player, you see a cozy virtual cabin with some chairs, but the network engineer sees a server farm practically melting down trying to render it. And it's not just the housing either. The sources mention some really complex AI mechanics in the combat system now, too.
Yeah, the Prey system. This is a really fascinating shift in core game logic. Usually in MMOs, enemies are just these dumb damage sponges that charge straight at you until one of you dies.
Right, the classic tank and spank.
Exactly. But in Midnight, they've introduced these behavioral AI algorithms where enemies will actually flee if they're losing.
Yeah.
You have to track them using actual predator-prey mechanics.
Which completely changes the fundamental loop of the game. You aren't just standing still, pressing a rotation of buttons anymore. You're actually hunting.
You are. And then you have to consider the map itself. They've introduced Khazad-dûm, which isn't just a big flat field, it's incredibly vertical. It goes five full layers deep underground.
I saw that in the preview materials. five distinct biomes stacked directly on top of each other, that has to be a total nightmare for memory management on the player's PC.
It is. It requires entirely new streaming level of detail techniques. The game engine has to figure out how to stream massive amounts of geographical and texture data without crashing your computer as you fly down a giant hole. It's a complete rewrite of how their world is rendered.
And clearly the business side thinks this massive infrastructure rebuild is worth the investment. I saw a prediction in the reports of 2.5 million new subscriptions in just the first 30 days.
That's the baseline estimate, yeah, which is roughly $37.5 million in revenue just from the monthly subs. That doesn't even count the box sales for the expansion itself.
That is staggering.
It proves that if you fix the infrastructure, if you finally give players the home they've wanted for two decades, the money absolutely follows.
Okay, so Blizzard is rebuilding the digital foundation, but obviously you can't access that digital world without the physical interface. So let's pivot to hardware, specifically what just happened in Barcelona at MWC 2026, because Honor just dropped something that honestly shouldn't exist.
The Honor Magic V6.
Yes. I'm looking at the spec sheet here from the sources, and I had to double check this number to make sure it wasn't a typo. 8.7 5 millimeters thick when closed.
That is correct.
Hold on. My standard, regular, non-folding phone sitting right here is thicker than that. They have effectively built a foldable phone that is thinner than a standard slab phone.
They have. That was always the holy grail benchmark they were aiming for in the industry. For years, the main argument against foldables was the sheer bulk in your pocket. Honor has just evaporated that argument entirely.
But how? Physically, where do the internal components go? You have to fit a massive hinge, two separate screens, and a battery into something that thin. It defies physics.
It's honestly a miracle of material science, specifically in the battery chemistry. They are using a new silicon carbon battery. It's a huge 6,600 milliamp hour cell.
Silicon carbon, wait, isn't that the same tech we are seeing in the new high-range electric vehicles right now to improve the energy density?
It's exactly the same principle. By using silicon carbon anodes instead of traditional graphite, you get about 15 to 20% higher energy density.
Okay, so more juice in a smaller box.
Right. You get way more power in a physically smaller space. That's how they shrank the battery footprint without killing the all-day battery life.
Okay, so the battery shrinks. That makes sense. But what about the hinge? Because that's usually the bulkiest part of a foldable and historically the part that breaks first.
This is where it gets really sci-fi. They're calling it the 6th-gen Falcon Wing hinge. It's actually made from a titanium-zirconium alloy.
Titanium-zirconium. That sounds like something straight out of an aerospace manufacturing manual.
It basically is.
Yeah.
That specific alloy is used in jet engine turbine blades. It is incredibly strong, but extremely light.
Wow.
This allows them to make the folding mechanism significantly smaller. They miniaturize the internal gears and the torque module without it just snapping in half under pressure. They say the hinge is certified good for 500,000 folds.
500,000. That is a lot of checking your notifications. But here's the part that I'm still a little skeptical about based on history. The durability. We've heard the promise of a durable foldable for 5 years now, and they still crack down the middle screen, or the inner display dies if you get a single speck of sand in the hinge. But the documentation says this thing has an IP69 rating.
This is the real game changer of the whole announcement. IP69 is totally unprecedented for a foldable device. It doesn't just mean you can drop it in the sink and it'll be fine. The 9 specifically means it can withstand high-pressure water jets and hot steam.
Wait, hot steam? Like up to what temperature?
Up to 80 degrees Celsius.
So I could technically take this super thin foldable phone into a sauna? I mean, not that I would recommend that to anyone listening, but the architecture actually allows for it?
Theoretically, yes, it would survive. The sealing system they developed uses nanometer scale gaskets. It's highly resistant to the kind of extreme air pressure changes you'd see in an aircraft cabin or really extreme weather environments. It really signals the end of the fragile foldable era.
That is a massive shot across the bow for Samsung and Google. Honor is basically standing up and saying, hey, we have completely solved the core engineering problems that you are still struggling with.
It really feels like the center of gravity for hardware innovation has fully shifted over to Shenzhen. They aren't just copying Western designs anymore. They are setting the frontier.
And speaking of shifting infrastructure, let's move to something invisible, but arguably even more critical to our daily lives. We've talked about game servers, we've talked about phone hinges. Now let's talk about the air itself, or rather, the intelligence traveling through it.
The NVIDIA AI RAN announcement.
Yes, AI RAN, AI-powered radio access network. Now, to the average person listening, cell tower infrastructure probably sounds like the most boring topic imaginable. It's usually just considered dumb pipes, right? Data goes in, data goes out.
Right. Historically, that's exactly what we call them, dumb pipes. A cell tower is basically just a signal relay. It takes the data from your phone, converts it, and shoves it into the core telecom network. It doesn't think. But NVIDIA is fundamentally changing that architecture. They're putting heavy AI compute directly on the tower.
Wait, on the tower itself? Not back in some distant cloud data center?
Exactly. On a physical metal box at the base of the antenna.
Okay, but why does that matter? Why does the local cell tower need a brain? Is this just NVIDIA slapping the AI buzzword onto telecom gear to boost the stock price?
No, this is actually about the laws of physics. Specifically, it's about latency. They did a live demonstration on stage with a robotic dog.
It is always a robot dog with these tech demos.
Always. But it's genuinely the best way to show off the tech visually. They actively controlled this robot dog from 50 kilometers away with less than 1 millisecond of latency.
Less than 1 millisecond.
Right. That response time is physically impossible if the control signal has to travel from the tower all the way to a centralized cloud server, get processed by an algorithm, and then travel all the way back. The physical distance is too great. The decision has to be made at the edge, right there on the tower itself.
So the physical tower is effectively becoming a high-powered computing platform.
Correct. And the implications for network efficiency are just wild. The AI can manage the radio spectrum in real time. So imagine you're at a massive stadium concert with 50,000 other people. Usually your cell signal just dies because the tower is completely overwhelmed. It physically can't sort the data packets fast enough for that many connections.
We've all been there. 4 bars of 5G, but nothing loads.
Exactly. But an AI RAN system uses advanced beamforming and dynamic frequency allocation. The AI adjusts the spectrum allocation every single second based on where the traffic spikes are occurring in the crowd.
So it's kind of like having a super intelligent traffic cop who can just instantly redraw the lanes on the highway to prevent a traffic jam before it even starts.
That is a perfect analogy. And for the major telecom companies, this is a massive financial lifesaver, entirely because of predictive maintenance. The AI essentially listens to the operating frequency of the tower equipment. It can identify a fan bearing starting to fail or a capacitor degrading weeks before it actually breaks down. NVIDIA is claiming a 40% reduction in maintenance costs for the carriers.
40% is huge for the bottom line. But looking forward, the sources suggest this AI RAN tech is actually the necessary groundwork for 6G.
We absolutely have to talk about 6G. It's expected to roll out around 2030, and the speeds and reliability they're promising for 6G are architecturally impossible without AI actively managing the radio layer. The mathematical complexity of the waveforms is just too high for standard hard-coded algorithms to process. So NVIDIA is essentially building the nervous system for the next entire decade of global communication.
It's fascinating. We are moving from physical hardware to these invisible, highly intelligent networks. But let's bring it back down to the consumer market for a second. Because while NVIDIA is quietly building the towers, there is a brutal war starting over the actual devices connecting to them. And it's not just about foldables like the Honor phone.
You're talking about the Xiaomi 17 Ultra.
Yeah, this one feels like a very direct, very aggressive attack on the current status quo. We've seen premium Xiaomi phones before, but this new collaboration with Leica feels different.
It is deeply significant. For a long time, the Leica brand in the mobile space was totally exclusive to Huawei. That partnership really defined high-end mobile photography for a few years. But now, Leica is putting their full name, the Lightstone branding, directly on a Xiaomi product.
And that matters because it gives Xiaomi instant premium credibility in Western markets.
It's exactly that. Western consumers, especially photography enthusiasts, deeply respect the name Leica. It's a 110-year-old German heritage brand. When you stamp that iconic red dot on a Chinese smartphone, it stops being perceived as just a cheap alternative and immediately starts being viewed as a luxury camera that happens to make phone calls.
And looking at the specs from the breakdown, they certainly aren't holding back on the hardware. They've got Samsung's massive 200 megapixel sensor in there, a 10x true optical zoom periscope lens. This is absolute top tier hardware.
Oh, and it's running the new Snapdragon 8 Elite Gen 5 under the hood too. But honestly, the real weapon here isn't the zoom lens or the processor, it's the price tag.
Right, it's launching at $899.
$899 to $99, depending on storage. Think about the direct competition right now. The iPhone 17 Pro Max, the Galaxy S26 Ultra, those flagship devices are going to be well over $1,200, maybe even pushing $1,400 this year.
So Xiaomi is coming in significantly cheaper, hundreds of dollars cheaper, with camera specs that arguably beat the heavyweights. That feels like a very deliberate geopolitical strategy to break the Apple and Samsung duopoly in the premium tier.
It absolutely is.
Yeah.
They're aggressively undercutting the market to shatter that dominance. Mm. And they are backing up that hardware pricing with a massive software ecosystem play. They've launched HyperOS 3.0, which seamlessly connects the new phone to their tablets, their laptops, and crucially, even their electric car, the SU7.
It's literally the Apple playbook. Buy our phone and suddenly your car and your laptop just work better together.
It is the exact Apple playbook, but executed at highly aggressive Chinese manufacturing prices. Mm-hmm. 2026 is really shaping up to be a brutal hardware price war. And the end consumer is the one who's going to benefit the most from that friction.
So we have the hardware wars. We have the network infrastructure wars. Let's shift gears slightly to the culture wars, or at least the infrastructure of the gaming industry itself, because there is a massive rebranding happening right now with GDC.
The GDC rebrand. Yes, this is fascinating from a sociological perspective.
For those who might not follow industry inside baseball, GDC is the Game Developers Conference. It's been around since the late 80s, and it has always been very B2B, very professional. You picture blazers, convention badges, and highly technical hour-long talks about volumetric lighting rendering. But this year, they've rebranded it to the GDC Festival of Gaming.
It's a pure survival mechanism. You have to look at this move through the context of what happened in 2025.
The massive industry layoffs.
Right. Over 15,000 jobs were lost in the gaming industry in 2025 alone. Studios were closing down left and right. Add in the rapid rise of generative AI threatening junior coding and art jobs. The old business model of hosting a dry, expensive, industry-only professional conference just isn't financially sustainable anymore. The corporate travel money just isn't there to support it.
So to survive, they are opening the doors to the general public, sort of becoming more like the old E3 used to be.
In a way, yes. They desperately need the broader community involved to drive ticket sales and revenue. Calling it a festival is a very clear signal that they need to rebuild the social infrastructure of gaming. They need to remind players and developers alike why they actually love games, not just how to code them efficiently.
And the lineup really reflects that mixture of high art and industry, right? You see Hideo Kojima coming back for the main keynote talking about Death Stranding 2. And interestingly, the French RPG Clair Obscur, Expedition 33, is leading all the award nominations.
Which is fantastic to see. A French indie slash mid-tier team leading the major nominations shows that the creative side of the industry is decentralizing away from just the massive studios in the US and Japan. But the core takeaway here is that GDC is actively rebuilding its own relevance. It's acknowledging that the strict wall between the developer and the player needs to come down if the industry is going to survive the current economic climate.
Speaking of why we love games, or, you know, maybe why we have absolute nightmares about them, we have to talk about the final piece of news from today, the return of Fatal Frame 2.
Crimson Butterfly.
Just saying the name honestly gives me chills. I played the original game back in 2003 on the PS2. It was completely terrifying. And now it's finally coming back.
March 12th. It's a full ground-up remake, launching on PS5, Xbox, and crucially, the Nintendo Switch 2.
Yeah, that Switch 2 detail really stuck out to me in the report. Nintendo is historically the family-friendly company. They make Mario, they make Zelda. Why are they actively pushing to launch one of the scariest psychological horror games ever made on their brand new console?
It is a very deliberate strategic pivot. Nintendo is aggressively targeting a mature audience with the Switch 2's early lifecycle. They know the kids will automatically buy the new Mario game. They don't have to market that. But they need the adults to buy the new hardware, too, and they need to show the market that the new console has some serious edge to it.
And for anyone listening who hasn't actually played Fatal Frame before, we really have to explain the core mechanic, because this isn't like Resident Evil. You don't get a shotgun or a rocket launcher to fight back.
No, you don't. And that's exactly why it's so brilliant. It represents a total rebuilding of the horror genre's infrastructure. For the last decade, survival horror mostly just became action games with dim lighting, lots of cheap jump scares and big guns. Fatal Frame completely rejects that modern formula.
You literally just have an antique camera, right?
A camera obscura. To deal any damage to the ghost attacking you, you have to take a photograph of it, which means you are forced to look directly at the horrifying thing that is trying to kill you through a tiny first-person viewfinder and just wait.
You can't just snap away wildly.
No, you do almost no damage that way.
Right.
You have to wait until the ghost is lunging right into your face to get the high-damage Fatal Frame shot.
It is pure weaponized anxiety.
It truly is. And with the new modern hardware, they are utilizing haptics in a way we really haven't seen in the genre before. The sources say you'll actually feel the breath of the spirits through the controller's micro-vibrations. And the adaptive trigger gives you heavy physical feedback, exactly like a real mechanical camera shutter snapping closed.
That sounds absolutely horrifying, and I love it. I can't wait to play it.
It's a genuine return to pure fear. It relies on atmosphere and deep dread. It's rebuilding the entire genre by stripping away the player's power fantasy.
So if we pull back and look at all of this together, what are we really seeing today? It's a lot of very different industries making announcements, but that core thread is definitely there.
We are seeing a massive global reset. Just think about the connections we've covered. Blizzard is rebuilding their foundational server architecture just to give us virtual homes. Honor is rebuilding the actual mechanical architecture of smartphones to make them foldable yet rugged.
Yeah.
NVIDIA is rebuilding the entire telecom grid with edge AI. Xiaomi is rebuilding the global market hierarchy through sheer pricing power. GDC is rebuilding the way the gaming industry gathers. And Fatal Frame is rebuilding the way we experience digital fear.
It really is infrastructure rebuilding completely across the board.
It actually reminds me of a quote from the architect that was mentioned in our source material. Those who build infrastructure own the future. Those who merely ship products remain tenants.
Wow. That is a really powerful way to frame it. We are essentially watching the landlords of the next decade lay their concrete foundations right now.
We really are. And the sheer speed at which it's happening, over 120 major products dropping in 24 hours, it just shows that the race to own that future is officially on.
So here's the question for you listening right now. If 2026 is truly the year of infrastructure, what does your personal infrastructure look like? In your career, in your business, in your day-to-day life, are you actively building a foundation that can handle the future? Kind of like an AI-driven cell tower? Or are you just renting space in a system that's about to become completely obsolete?
That really is the question we all need to ask ourselves today.
Definitely something to chew on while you're waiting in that massive queue for the new WoW W servers. Thanks for diving in with us today. We will catch you next time.